enforcement assets to either coerce or control scapegoated populations, as we saw in Los Angeles recently, is consistent. And this is in particular an escalation, because while he tested the waters in deploying the Marines and 4,000 National Guard troops in Los Angeles, now we see the takeover, as Monica has already described, of a local police department. And while he has, as we've discussed, that right to do so, at least for a limited period, it's not clear that he's not going to stop. He's calling for the same in New York. He's calling for the same in Chicago. And I just want to remind everyone that the Trump administration elected in 2016 came in riding on a lie about American carnage in American cities. This was also a period of dramatically declined crime rates and violent crime rates in particular across U.S. cities. So there is nothing here that is factual in terms of the pretext for the calls here. What is consistent is Donald Trump's use of racist rhetoric, racist ideas, and the use of policing to enact a domestic policy agenda.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad, can you also talk about the fact that the DOJ recently lifted the consent decrees over police departments that have histories of brutality? So on the one hand, you have that. On the other hand, of course, he is naming from Oakland to Baltimore, from L.A. to Chicago to New York, historically communities with large black and brown communities.
That's right. Listen, we are way past any notion here that these are legitimate concerns. You've already pointed out that the 1,600 insurrectionists, many of whom posed an absolute direct threat to law enforcement, 140 injured, as you mentioned, means that there's no neutral ground upon which we could have a factual discussion, and then we might lead to different interpretations, but we're not even dealing with facts here. And it's really, really important that you point out the removal of consent decrees, particularly for Minneapolis, which the former Department of Justice under the Biden administration and Merrick Garland in particular identified a pattern and practice of wide-scale discrimination and unconstitutional policing. Donald Trump doesn't care about any rule of law. What he cares about is flexing the power of the executive branch of government against named and so-called enemies. And as long as he can get away with it without congressional oversight and a claim of a popular mandate, which, of course, is not entirely true from the election, but nevertheless, he is using the pretext of public opinion who elected him to get away with this. And it is a slide towards a fascism. All of this is textbook around the world. And we ought to be deeply concerned about the future of all of us with respect to the capacity of this particular president to use and threaten a coercive state violence against his so-called enemies.
I wanted to ask you also about the inclusion of the homeless in this latest press conference that the president had on Sunday when, en route from the White House to his golf course in Virginia, he wrote on Truth Social, "The homeless have to go out immediately and that we will give you places to stay, but far from the Capitol."
Well, again, I think a global perspective is very helpful here. We've seen the same president threaten to turn Gaza into the Riviera of the Middle East. That is a massive population experiencing ethnic cleansing and genocide. The definition of houselessness or homelessness doesn't even apply at the scale of a humanitarian crisis. So in the United States, the same policies are essentially shovel ready for this person, for this president, meaning that the criminalization of people who are victims of an unequal society, of the criminalization of poverty by often local officials who have not found the resources to support the health care and housing needs of homeless populations. So then to essentially threaten to turn those populations into criminal populations, that is, to treat them as if their poverty is a crime, is consistent, again, with the policies of this administration when it comes to people, both in the U.S. and in Gaza and in other parts of the world.
In fact, what percentage, I don't know if you know, of the unhoused are veterans?
I don't know in D.C., but Monica may. It's significant. But yes, we know. I mean, it would be laughable if it weren't so dangerous and absurd. But again, this is a president, we should remind folks, who ran by mocking veterans in this country, who claims the mantle of being the toughest commander in chief, but who consistently disrespects those who have served in this country. And in this case, as you mentioned, Amy, who may in fact be experiencing houselessness in a disproportionate way in this country.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad, we thank you so much for being with us, professor of African American Studies and Public Affairs at Princeton, author of the book, The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America, speaking to us from the historically black community of Oak Bluffs and Martha's Vineyard. Coming up, from deploying troops at home to deploying them abroad, Trump has secretly signed a directive approving the use of military force on foreign soil. He says it's to target Latin American drug cartels. Stay with us.
El viento a mi favor y a navegar hacia un viaje mejor y a contemplar la infinidad del sol con la certeza de un trato mejor. Fiel a tus valores debes ir, caminar por esa senda y resistir para que tú conquistes ese buen vivir, que aunque lo tengan todo, no te tienen a ti, que los peces gordos no pueden volar.
Ana Tijoux in our Democracy Now! Studio. To see her interview and her singing, go to democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn from deploying troops at home to deploying them abroad. The New York Times reveal President Trump secretly signed a directive approving the Pentagon's use of military force on foreign soil. He says to target Latin American drug cartels. According to the Times, the order provides the Pentagon authority to direct military operations at sea and on foreign soil against cartels designated by the Trump administration to be terrorist organizations. Last week, Secretary of State Marco Rubio spoke about targeting drug cartels during an interview with the Catholic news outlet EWTN.
It allows us to now target what they're operating and to use other elements of American power, intelligence agencies, the Department of Defense, whatever, to target these groups if we have an opportunity to do it. We have to start treating them as armed terrorist organizations, not simply drug dealing organizations. Right. Drug dealing is the kind of terrorism they're doing, and it's not the only.
Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum lashed out at Trump's move, saying the United States is going to come to Mexico with the military. We cooperate, we collaborate, but there is not going to be an invasion. That's ruled out, absolutely ruled out. President Sheinbaum spoke at a news conference Monday.
I was informed there would be an order, but it has nothing to do with the country of Mexico. It has to do with their country, not our country.
For more, we're joined by Alexander Avina. He has extensively researched and written about capitalism, the U.S.-backed war on drugs and state violence, associate professor of Latin American history at Arizona State University, author of the award-winning book Specters of Revolution, Peasant Guerrillas in the Cold War Mexican Countryside. Welcome, Democracy Now!, Professor. If you can start off by talking about the significance of this secret directive that Trump has signed for Mexico and beyond.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. This is, I think, a really dangerous directive that threatens to generate and unleash violence throughout any of the Latin American countries that the Trump administration may target under this broadly defined, struggle against terrorism that they are now using to describe their fight against Latin American drug cartels. Part of one of the things that we should start with is to think about how the war on drugs is never really about drugs. It's a war against the way it's unfolded in Latin America in the last five, six decades. It's actually a war against poor people. So the Trump administration may say that the targets are, six different transnational drug trafficking organizations from Mexico, two from Central America, and one shadowy one from Venezuela. But the people who are going to suffer from any sort of unilateral U.S. military action in Latin America are everyday civilians and communities, because it's really difficult to discern in many instances who is a narco and who is not a narco for a variety of different reasons. And also we need to think about how the U.S. historically has used the war on drugs as another way to advance U.S. imperial geopolitical designs in the Western Hemisphere, using it to attack governments that they deem to be a threat to U.S. national security, while at the same time working with unsavory governments who are actually involved in drug trafficking. But because they're anti-communist and authoritarian, the U.S. is willing to work with them. And we have ample examples from history that should play this out.
And yes, Professor, I wanted to follow up with that in terms of this whole idea of this being new for the U.S. military being involved in Latin America. Of course, there were reports that the Delta Force commandos were involved with the Colombian military in the killing of Pablo Escobar in 1993. Of course, the CIA's direct involvement in the killing of Che Guevara, the U.S. military providing air support for the Bay of Pigs invasion. There's so many of these examples of the U.S. military directly intervening in Latin American countries. So this isn't really anything new, is it? What I found most interesting was this doubling of the reward for the capture of Nicolas Maduro, who's already been indicted for drug trafficking here in the United States, even though there's very scant evidence of that in his own home country.
No, you're entirely correct, Juan. I think this is the immediate context of this directive. The way I see it is the recent announcement that the bounty on Nicolas Maduro had been raised to $50 million because he's alleged by the U.S. government to be the head of this shadowy drug cartel organization called El Cartel de los Soles, or the Cartel of the Suns. And let's recall that there's been regime change efforts and operations against Venezuela going back to the Obama administration, when he designated Venezuela to be a national security threat. During the first Trump administration, they ratcheted up economic sanctions and waged a level of economic warfare that has produced a Great Depression, a U.S.-style Great Depression on different orders of magnitude, according to reporting of Jeff Stein from The Washington Post. In 2020, we had, I think that was the first time that Nicolas Maduro was charged to be involved in drug trafficking efforts into the United States. So this is, we don't have time to go back all the way to post-World War II and all the different times during the Cold War that the U.S. Used, again, the war on drugs to support pliant authoritarian right-wing allies while going after revolutionary governments. There's numerous instances. But I think in this, the immediate context in this situation is that this is part, I think it's directed mostly at Venezuela. I think it's part of an attempt to continue regime change operations. And this is, again, Venezuela offers a really interesting case study, because the very counter-narcotic efforts that the U.S. is waging against Venezuela attacks and affects everyday people in Venezuela, and then generates the very processes that the Trump administration tries to fight at the U.S.-Mexico border, namely mass displacement and people robbed of the right to stay home, who then flee their country because of this economic warfare and then try to make it into the United States. So that's one of the insidious things about the war on drugs is, one, it's never going to end because it's not about drugs. And two, it generates the very processes that it says it's fighting against. And in this situation, we have a combination of the war on drugs, the global war on terror, and the war on migrants.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you briefly also about how Mexico's president, Claudia Sheinbaum, has been dealing with not only the militarization of the border, but now these threats of possible U.S. intervention against the cartels within her own country.
It's really difficult to be a neighbor of the United States, because also what this issue brings up is the U.S.'s historical and current claim that it can violate the national sovereignty of any Latin American Caribbean nation when it sees fit on whatever premise or justification that it wants to use. President, for historically, Mexico has had a tense, fraught relationship with the United States because of the United States' unwillingness to recognize the national sovereignty and the self-determination of its southern border. That's why the U.S. has invaded Mexico on several times and taken half of its national territory in the 19th century. So President Claudia Sheinbaum has to walk a tightrope. On the one hand, has to constantly and consistently defend the national sovereignty of her country. But drug trafficking and drug production is a real issue. So how do you how do you collaborate in a cooperative, productive way with a neighbor who for the last 3-4 years has been saying, you know, we want to invade Mexico or engage in different types of military activities against drug trafficking organizations based in Mexico? So she's in a really difficult situation. You know, her predecessor, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, famously expelled the DEA from Mexico. But military to military relationships and contacts never ended. We have special forces units within the U.S. military who continue to train their counterparts in the Mexican military, plans and programs that have continued under President Sheinbaum. So she's walking a tightrope, and it's really, she also has to deal with the tariff issues. So I would not want to be in her position. But I think what she comes back to is consistently defending the national sovereignty of Mexico, and as she should, as I think is the appropriate way forward.
Alexander Vigna, I want to thank you for being with us, Associate Professor of Latin American History at Arizona State University, extensively researched the U.S.-backed so-called war on drugs and state violence. Speaking to us from Phoenix, Arizona, please stay after the show. We'd like to do a post-show in Spanish, and we will post it online at democracynow.org. Next up, the U.N. Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression, Irene Khan, on Israel's assassination of 6 Palestinian journalists in Gaza. 5 from Al Jazeera. Stay with us. By the late, great Randy Weston. To see our interview with him and his performance, you can go to democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Global condemnation is mounting over Israel's assassination of one of the most prominent journalists in Gaza, the Al Jazeera correspondent Anas al-Sharif, along with 4 of his colleagues at the network, and another freelance journalist. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is calling for an independent investigation after the 5 journalists were killed in a targeted Israeli strike outside Al-Shifa Hospital in a tent clearly marked in Gaza City. European Union officials and international press freedom groups have also denounced the assassinations. The 6th journalist, freelance reporter Mohammed Al-Khaldi, was also killed in the same strike. Minutes before the strike, al-Sharif posted to X, quote, "If this madness does not end, Gaza will be reduced to ruins, its people's voices silenced, their faces erased, and history will remember you as silent witnesses to a genocide you chose not to stop," unquote. On Monday, crowds of mourners gathered for a funeral procession for al-Sharif and his colleagues, marching from al-Shifa to Sheikh Radwan Cemetery in central Gaza, carrying the journalists' bodies wrapped in white sheets, a dark blue flak press jacket, and a Palestinian flag were placed on al-Sharif's remains. People embraced as they decried Israel's relentless targeting of journalists in Gaza. Meanwhile, at rallies and vigils worldwide, people are demanding accountability for the attack on journalists, including in Tunisia, Belfast, Dublin, Berlin, London, Oslo, Stockholm, and Washington, D.C. For more, we go to Geneva, Switzerland, where we're joined by Irene Khan, UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Opinion and Expression. She served as Secretary General of Amnesty International from 2001 to 2009. Irene Khan, welcome back to Democracy Now! In late July, You publicly denounced Israel's threats against Anas al-Sharif. Can you talk about what you understood at that time? And then this young reporter, 28 years old, response to your press statement.
Yes, well, Anas actually contacted me and Al Jazeera contacted me to tell me of this impending threat on his head. They had seen it before. He's not the first one, as you know. There are some anything between 26 to 30 journalists who have been targeted in this campaign of assassination. And Anas wanted me to go public. He wanted others to go public to stop what Israel was doing. But at the same time, he thanked me for my support. And then he said nothing would stop him from speaking the truth. And in a way, he signed his own death warrant by that, because, as you know, he and the others, Al Jazeera's entire team in northern Gaza, were killed, murdered, just as Israel ramps up its military action on the city, Gaza City. So there is a clear pattern here of killing journalists to clear the path, to silence voices, to stop the international global opinion from being informed of what of the genocide in Gaza.
And Irene Han, the number of journalists, so more than 200 have been killed in Gaza. That's more than all the journalists killed in World War One, World War Two, Korea, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and the Afghanistan War combined. Your sense of the Israeli impunity here and being able to basically kill the core of journalists that are still able to report from Gaza?
You have to take into account that Israel has refused to give access to international media. So these are all local Gazan journalists who are putting their lives on the line to keep the world informed. Many of them, you named some 200, many of them, of course, have been killed in the intensity of the battle. Many of them have been killed while asleep in their own apartments. But these cases, the cases of Anas now and his colleagues, and a number of other cases of targeted killing, is really murder. It is not killing in the context of war. It is a deliberate strategy to stop independent voices reporting. So it's as much a threat to independent journalism as it is to the journalists themselves, as well as a blatant attempt by the Israelis to stop the world witnessing what they are doing.
And these killings also came as the Israeli government announced they're unleashing a new operation in the area of Gaza. Who will be left to document this operation now?
Well, absolutely. And that is why Anas got in touch with me, because he realized what was happening. You know, from his message on LinkedIn and from his message that he has sent to me and to others, it was very, very clear. He has been there on the ground since October 2023. He could see the pattern. He could see what was happening. He knew they were coming for him. And that is why it's incumbent on all of us now not to just condemn, but actually to act before independent media is totally obliterated from Gaza.
Irene Khan, I want to ask what you're calling for and the significance of Netanyahu holding this news conference on Sunday and saying he has now said that the Israeli military can bring in journalists, but they're most concerned about protecting their safety. A few hours later is when Israel assassinated these six journalists. Now, it is the first time, NPR reports, since October 2023, that Israel so quickly took responsibility for their assassination. You know, compare it to Shireen Abu Akleh, May 11th, 2022, when Israel said it is not clear. And then, you know, so many studies were done, but it became very clear. Talk about what you are calling for at this point.
Yes. Well, it's not actually an admission of taking responsibility, because there is no accountability in it. It's actually a brazen attempt to show the world that the Israeli army can work as it wishes, regardless of international humanitarian law that protects journalists as civilians. Now, what I'm calling for is, of course, independent investigation, truly independent investigation. But I'm also calling for protection of journalists on the ground and for access to international journalists. Israel always covers these assassinations and murders with allegations and smear campaigns. The journalists are simply agents of Hamas or members of Hamas, and that kind of gives Israel a veil of impunity. It's important for international journalists to be on the ground so they can actually investigate and expose this false story and the string of assassinations that Israel is carrying out. And I think we need to remember the message Israel's action is sending to the rest of the world, because there are other spots, other conflict areas, where also others are learning that you need to be just brazen and go ahead and kill journalists, and you can get away with it.
Quickly, Irene Khan, we're speaking to you in Geneva, Switzerland. Geneva, the Geneva Conventions. Can you talk about how the conventions specifically protect journalists?
Well, the convention gives journalists civilian status, which means that, like all other civilians, they should not be targeted during the war. The problem is the journalists are not just civilians. They are the kind of civilians that have to go to the front line and not run away somewhere else. You know, they are not like women and children who can move and seek shelter elsewhere. They have to be where the fighting is, and that exposes them. They're much more like humanitarian workers. And journalists need to be recognized as humanitarian workers. There needs to be, I believe, there needs to be additional protection given to them because it shows how vulnerable they are, on the one hand, to attacks, and on the other hand, how important their work is to the rest of the world, to any peace process, to any attempt to have accountability and justice for the victims.
And we only have about a minute left, but I wanted to ask you that last month, the union representing reporters at the French press agency, AFP, warned that the agency staff are in danger of starving to death. And they issued an open letter condemning what Israel is doing in terms of denying food, not to the population in general, but also to journalists as well. Your response?
Well, absolutely. These journalists are local journalists, as I said. So they have faced all the problems that the population is facing. They've had their own families killed. They have to hunt for food, even as they hunt for news. So they've been put in a terrible situation. And that's why Israel has to open the gates, not under military protection, but allow journalists independently to come and investigate. It has to stop the starvation, the blockade. It has to allow humanitarian assistance to come in. And it has to agree to a ceasefire. And of course, stop the genocide.
I want to end with the words of Anas al-Sharif himself, anticipating his own murder by Israeli forces. He wrote a pre-prepared message that was posted on his X account after his death. Al Jazeera read part of his message on air.
If these words reach you, know that Israel has succeeded in killing me and silencing my voice. I have lived through pain in all its details, tasted suffering and loss many times. Yet I never once hesitated to convey the truth as it is, without distortion or falsification, so that God may bear witness against those who stayed silent and accepted our killing. He ends, "Do not forget Gaza, and do not forget me in your sincere prayers for forgiveness and acceptance."
The words of Anas al-Sharif, posted after he was killed by the Israeli military, along with five other journalists. Five of them were with Al Jazeera. Irene Khan, I want to thank you so much for being with us, UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Opinion and Expression, speaking to us from Geneva, Switzerland. To see our interview with the managing editor of Al Jazeera, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Massoud, Safwat Nazal. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Starting from the week of Monday, May 30th, The Student Union Building is open 7 days a week, from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. The sub-building common spaces, along with the bookable spaces, are available for use. Any comments or questions, please go to the Simon Fraser Student Society website at sfss.ca for more information. CJ,